I'm Christopher Lydon, absorbing the cell phone news from Cairo with the Iranian-American historian of the Middle East, Shiva Balaghi. What do friends in Tahrir Square tell you? What does the modern Middle East record from Iran in 1979 to Tunisia this winter tell you about the sort of revolution we're watching in Egypt? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one, on day 8 of the People's Uprising in Egypt, is about how to make sense of a world historical event as it happens. It's educated guesswork, perhaps, but let's try. What broke the dam? And where is this flood of pent-up power moving? Shiva Balaghi was born in Nashville, Tennessee. She grew up also in Iran in the Shah's time. She trained as an historian at the University of Michigan. Shiva, I want to get to the maybe cautionary parallels between the uprisings in Iran 30 years ago and Egypt today. But tell us how you're watching Cairo on this Million March day, and what do you think is happening?
So Sunday morning, I was reading the New York Times, and I heard that cell phone had been opened again in Cairo. So I thought I'd call some of my Egyptian friends to see how they were doing. Just, hey, are you okay? Is your family okay? And they were saying, you know, tell the Americans this, tell the Americans that, please tell them this. So I started to take notes on my laptop of what they were saying, and putting the transcriptions of the conversations together with my friend's permission. And so here's a direct quote that one of my friends who's in Tahrir Square said to me on the phone. He said, "We want new elections to set up a committee to write a new constitution. We want clean elections. Once we have a new constitution, we can elect a new government. We are not less than South Africa. Tell the Americans we are not less than South Africa. We deserve our rights. Clinton just spoke. She says we deserve human rights. We want political rights. Please tell the people in America we want our rights." And that's a very big message that I hear them say is, you know, the world community stood behind South Africa to help end apartheid and to help the South African people develop a new constitutional system where they could elect their own leader. And the Egyptians are proud. You know, we are not less than South Africa. You know, we want to have our rights also. Another really beautiful message that I have, who's from Amal, she's an artist. And this is an important thing, too, that I'm hearing from the people in the streets of Cairo, is they're not afraid of Mubarak anymore. I mean, Mubarak's thugs have been picking people off the streets, taking them to police stations, beating them to death, torturing them. A lot of people have stayed home because they're afraid. And the politics of fear, the hold the fear has over the Egyptian people has gone away. So this is a quote from an artist, very young artist. She's 30-something. This is what she says. "No more intimidation. Our fear is gone. On the streets, no one is thinking, I am Christian or Muslim. We are all one. I am honored to be part of this and for my son to witness an era, a new era, and have a better future. Mubarak is gone. We will march tomorrow until he leaves." So that's another quote that we had. And this is something that's really beautiful, too. I'm seeing a lot of people quoting Sha'abi poetry, which is, you know, street poetry, poetry of the people. And my friend Elliot Kola, who teaches at Georgetown, he used to teach at Brown until recently, has been translating a lot of this poetry and putting it out on the internet. And then I'm finding Egyptian artists and intellectuals reciting and citing this is Sha'abi poetry, poetry of the people. So here's one that an artist put up on her website. She says, "If one day a people desires to live, then fate will answer their call, and their night will then begin to fade, and their chains break and fall." So people of all different, the intellectuals are drawing inspiration from the common people in the street, from the youth in the street. Even Muhammad al-Bardai says, the youth are leading this political movement. We are following the footsteps of the youth. This is a populist, popular, young political movement that's happening in the streets of Cairo. It's very exciting.
Shiva Balaghi, there's nobody I'd rather hear tear and compare the revolutions in Iran in 1979 and in Egypt this winter. A lot of people want to be warned by what happened in Iran, not just an Islamic nation kind of rising up, throwing off a terribly flawed dictator that the American government loved. It's happening again in Egypt. But the fact that the Iranian revolution turned so sour on us, took our embassy and has been sticking it to us ever since. What correspondence should we look for, and what sort of red herring should we beware of here?
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to say that a lot of my friends who are involved with what's going on in the streets of Cairo openly say, we don't want to be another Iran. And by that, they mean we don't want the Islamists to take over. The Muslim Brotherhood is very different from the Ayatollah Khomeini's movement. So the Muslim Brotherhood has been part of Egyptian life for decades. Al-Azhar is the oldest Islamic university in the world. Mm-hmm. The Muslim Brotherhood are trained there. They've been part of electoral politics in Egypt. They have political representation. They have representation in the parliament. Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 had been living in exile from Iran for many years. He had been censored. He'd been banned. Very few people other than the truly Muslim parts of the political movements knew who Ayatollah Khomeini was. So when he was sitting in Paris and he would say, oh, I want all the people to have rights, we just want to, you know, for the Shah to go away. And he gave very vague kind of, you know, interviews, and people kind of believed, it took him at face value, and a lot of people didn't investigate what he was actually saying. So in that sense, kind of this notion that any sort of political movement and any sort of revolution in the Middle East is necessarily going to produce an Islamic State is something we need to be careful about, because this is precisely what Mubarak has used to convince the Americans to support him. You know, you better keep supporting me, otherwise the opposition is going to be an Islamic State. But actually, the people that you see, people in Cairo saying that they want to lead their political parties, are Ayman Nour, who's a lawyer, who's secular. Mohammed Al-Berdai, who has a law degree from NYU Law School, who worked for the UN. So a lot of the secular parties, they don't have a big, broad political base because Mubarak hasn't allowed them to. But they're there. I predict, I mean, this is, you know, whenever a historian predicts, it's a bad call because, you know, we're much better at telling you what happened yesterday than trying to guess what's going to happen tomorrow. But Muslim Brotherhood has been very savvy in this. They've participated in the street protests. They haven't taken a leadership role. They know that if they take a leadership role in this protest movement, at least half the people that are out there protesting will go home, because they don't want to be seen as protesting in support of Muslim Brotherhood, A. B, they know that a lot of the international community will turn its back on this protest movement if they perceive it as being a Muslim Brotherhood protest movement. So the Muslim Brotherhood is being savvy. I think that there's a possibility, if the international community, Turkey, the EU, the United States, gets together and says, okay, look, Mubarak, you're out of here. You know, go find yourself a villa, whether it's in Dubai, whether it's in Saint-Tropez, whether you go to your townhouse in London, where his son and his wife apparently already are. You're gone. Now let's put together a transitional system. Let's let Mohammed Al-Berdai be the transitional leader. Let's set in place a 6-month timeline for Egypt's judges to work with the political parties and draft a new constitution. Let's have a clean election that's monitored from Egypt's own civil society and really put in place a true parliamentary democracy. That's what the people in the streets of Cairo want. And if the international community can help them implement the framework for that, then you're going to get the Muslim Brotherhood. They're going to be part of the electoral system. They're going to have members in parliament. And they may well act the way that the religious parties in the Israeli electoral system act, where, you know, Muslim Brotherhood's never achieved more than 20% of the vote. So they're going to have 20% of the vote. They're going to have X number of seats in the parliament. They could well play a pivotal role in forming coalition governments, the way the religious groups do in the Israeli Knesset. but they're probably never going to get enough votes to be able to form their own government, to be able to be take over a leadership position. So this is an opportunity to allow the Muslim Brotherhood to act like a political party in Egypt, the way the Tea Party acts as a political movement in the United States. You know?
That's interesting. But let me say, I'm still unclear about the Muslim Brotherhood. There was a period in Nasser time when he, as a secular reformer, often anti-American, was giving us a hard time, that the United States government encouraged the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes. One of the things that started with the United States in the 40s and 50s, particularly in the early 50s, was this notion that the best bulwark against communism is Islam. The communists are atheists. The Middle Eastern people are religious. So if we can support these Islamic groups, then they will be our best bulwark against the socialists, against the non-aligned movement like Nasser, and against the communists. But Iraq and Iran had big communist parties. They both also had a lot of oil. So, you know, the United States at various times has had different attitudes about Islam in terms of how it fits into the foreign policy. When Islam was seen as an anti-communist threat in Afghanistan, in Egypt, in Iran, in Iraq, it was supported. All the way through Jimmy Carter's time. You know, Brzezinski's been very clear about this. And now it's seen as this, anyone who's Muslim and anyone who's Islamic is potentially a threat, potentially a terrorist threat. The both extremes don't really allow us to get a clear view of what's happening. But the Muslim Brotherhood is very well understood in the United States. There's many leading scholars who've written books about the Muslim Brotherhood, have written articles about the Muslim Brotherhood. It's an open society. It's a known society. There's no reason for people in the United States to be afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a well-known, documented group.
But then they reappeared in everybody's consciousness as the people who assassinated Anwar Sadat after his peace with Israel. I mean, what does that count? What does that tell you today?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm saying that they're a known and understood society. I'm not saying that they're, you know, everything that they've ever done in history is peaceful and wonderful. It was, you know, you have to understand the Muslim Brotherhood was completely from Nasser through Sadat, not allowed to have any. They were banned. They were thrown in prison. They were not allowed to participate openly in society at all. And Mubarak changed this a little bit. I mean, Mubarak gave them a little bit of a voice, allowed them to be legal, allowed them to have electoral power. And they've reached kind of an accommodationist role with the Mubarak government.
Have they changed?
Well, I think that they, you know, look, when you're banned and you're not allowed to participate in society peacefully, then you have two options. Either go away or resort to non-governmental means to let yourself be heard. So if you allow them to participate in a government in a legal way, the Muslim Brotherhood has shown that they will participate in a legal way. So does that, you know, having Hosni Mubarak and Anwar Sadat as secular dictators did not prevent all acts of Islamic terrorism from happening in Egypt. They still blew up tourist buses in Luxor. They still assassinated Anwar Sadat. So this gives a lie to this notion that if you have a secular dictator, then Islam as a threat is removed. You know, I mean, we support Saudi Arabia as a stalwart, you know, security friend of the United States. And most of the guys who flew the planes that attacked America on 9/11 were Saudi. So, you know, I think, you know, look, I'm somewhat naive, but I actually take President Obama at his word. And when President Obama was in Cairo in June 2009, he said, "Truly stable governments are those that represent the will of the people." And if you allow people to express their will politically in a democratic way, they're less inclined to resort to violence. So I'm prepared to take President Obama at his word. He's a smart guy. He was a law professor. I mean, you know.
No, but
he's educated.
There's only one question at the end, though. Could the United States government, and especially its friend in Israel, live with a government in Egypt that was dominated or heavily influenced by the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, look, this is what I have to say to that. And I think that this is what one of my friends who was in the streets of Cairo said about this. He said, please explain to the people in the United States, we want our rights. Please explain, we can't communicate with them directly because we don't have internet. Everyone has to understand that the rights of the Egyptian people are being sold out for Israel's security. Our rights are being sold. It's as if we're monkeys. They have one strategic consideration, and that's Israel. So there is this sense on the streets of Tahrir that the United States is maybe being a little bit more concerned about who Israel wants to be the next leader of Egypt than who the Egyptian people want to be the next leader of Egypt. Mm. And that the security and comfort level of Israel with what the next political system in Egypt is going to look like is taking front and center in this decision-making process. And I think it's really imperative for the United States and Israel to not make it seem that that's the case.
But why? I mean, the Iranian Revolution of 79 has brought us too close for comfort to a nuclear confrontation between the United States, Israel, Saudi pressure, and Iran. I mean, could that be the story of a Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt down the road?
I think it's important that you ask that question, Chris, because it tells, I think it gives voice to what perhaps a lot of people are fearing, but it really has, to be honest, very little basis in the actual conditions that we're dealing with at the time. And I think it's really important for us to step back and really think about what's happening and really look at what the current realities are and base our decisions about what the United States relations with Egypt are going to be based on what's actually happening in Egypt and less about our fears about what might happen. So everyone in the streets of Tahrir is saying, we don't want to have anything to do with Iran. We don't want to have an Islamic State. So let's take them at their word. I mean, they're saying we want a constitutional, fair, elected, democratic government like the United States has. So let's kind of take them at their face value and see if we can't help them and support them with that. The Muslim Brotherhood is saying we will support al-Baradei being the transitional government. And if it's not al-Baradei, we will work with the other political parties to form a coalition government. So let's take them at their face value. Now, there was a CNBC reporter on the streets of Cairo this morning with this million march movement that's going on. And she interviewed people and she asked them, if Mubarak leaves, what do you think Egypt should do with Israel? And they all said, we don't like what Israel is doing to Palestine. We don't like that, Egypt doesn't stand up more to Israel, but we don't want to end the peace with Israel. No new Egyptian government is going to want the threat of military confrontation with anybody, much less with Israel. So it's actually feasible to put in place a new democratically elected leadership in Egypt that's going to be secular, that's going to accommodate the Muslim Brotherhood, that's going to also accommodate the Tomorrow Party and all these other secular parties that are out there, part of the Egyptian scheme, that will be continuing in its peaceful relations with Israel. I mean, it's actually based on what we see happening in the streets of Egypt today. That is not an unlikely scenario. So I think the United States would do better to build its foreign policy decisions based on what's actually happening in Cairo rather than fears of perhaps what might happen someday. Because if the United States doesn't support this freedom movement in Egypt, it might actually help create that scenario which it fears the most. You know, if the United States is seen as privileging Israel's security over the free will of the Egyptian people, then all those people who are on the streets of Egypt are going to be mad at Israel and are going to be mad at the United States. Today, they're not chanting anti-Israel slogans. They're not burning Israeli flags. They're not chanting anti-American slogans. They're not burning American flags. But if we stand in their way, what do you think is going to happen? Not a good outcome. So I think that it's okay for us as Americans also to take a leap of faith and bring to life that promise that President Obama gave on June 2009, that if the Arab people would rise up and act like good, responsible, democratic citizens, the United States would help them. It's okay for us to take that leap of faith.
Shiva Balagi, I'm also struck, as you suggest, that this revolution strikes home to America in a very profound way. We talk about teaching democracy, but in fact, we're learning it, as if for the first time, from very brave people defying our friend, the thug, in that government. We're having to see, I mean, talk about freedom and censorship. We have not been able to watch Al Jazeera on American television. Why not? We're seeing that so much of the repression is done with made in America machinery, this kind of thing. What do you suppose we Americans are already going through here, willy-nilly? And what do we have to learn about a new place in the world?
Well, you know, Chris, I'm an Iranian American. When I was 20 years old, I lived exactly half my life in the States and half my life in Iran. And I speak both languages fluently. And I grew up explaining Iran to Americans and explaining America to Iranians. So before I became a professional, this was just kind of how I live my life, is translating these two worlds to one another. And I grew up in my parents were college students in America in the 60s, and JFK was president, and American cars were good cars, and American presidents were good men. And, you know, my dad had a bust of JFK in his study, and it had a little sign that said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." So, you know, the entire history of the United States and the Middle East has not been a bad, abysmal, bleak one. And the entire history of the United States and Egypt has not been a bad, abysmal, bleak one. Remember, after all, the United States, Woodrow Wilson was the one who said, you know, the former provinces of the Ottoman Empire must be given self-determination.
Yeah, we stopped the British and Israeli invasion of Egypt.
In the Suez Canal.
Amen.
Fast forward
to Dwight D. Eisenhower saying, no way.
Fast forward to the Eisenhower administration. We just marked, you know, the anniversary of his military-industrial complex speech. Eisenhower, you know, stood up, you know, when the Israelis and the French and the British invaded the Sinai. He said, no, you've got to respect Egypt's autonomy. You've got to, you know, withdraw your soldiers. So there is a history of the United States actually being supportive of Egypt and having good relations with Egypt. And there are many, many Americans who've lived in Egypt, who live in Egypt now. There are many, many, you know, when we have in any American university right now, there's going to be so many students who study abroad in Cairo. Cairo is one of the top three destinations for study abroad programs amongst American students right now. There's a lot of good relations between Egypt and the United States that we can build on to create a better and safer and more secure alternative policy for both the Egyptians and for the United States. So I think this is really important for us to bear in mind right now. And sometimes we just have to have bilateral relations. You know, we can't always mediate American foreign policy through the lens of Israel. And I honestly, I mean, I can't imagine any Egyptian administration coming into place right now that is democratically elected, that's going to take a hostile, antagonistic relationship against against Israel. Remember, the regime in Iran was not democratically elected. Sometimes the Iran metaphor can actually obfuscate and confuse more than it can clarify. In Iran, you have an Islamic state. The government is Islamic, but the people are pretty secular. In Egypt, you have a secular state, but the people are pretty Muslim. So I think we need to be careful not to confuse devout respect for Islam with the desire of the Egyptian people to have an Islamic state. I mean, they've been very, very clear in saying that they don't want to have a state that's going to be led by the Muslim Brotherhood. So I think, you know, we tried it the other way. It hasn't worked out too well. So let's be optimistic for a change.
How can we not? Shiva Balagi, it's a huge thrill to be watching the world this week. Certainly not since the Berlin Wall fell down, maybe not since the end of World War II, have you sensed just a whole world of possibilities opening up. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me today, Chris.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.